You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast.
And welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Professor Carlton Shield Chief Gover. Something where something Great Plains voices things. I forgot the intro to my own podcast. Where we uncover the past about the story and rich history of North America's Great Plains. Something along those lines. And we're back today with episode 27. Today we have two guests who have appeared on the podcast before. We have Chance Ward and Terrell Iron Eyes. We had Terrell back in his episode dropped in like June. And Chance's episode dropped two weeks ago. So Chance is right back on. So today we're experiencing with a two-parter episode. So part one, you guys are listening to it now. Part two will drop in 2 weeks. So it's one full hour-long discussion between the three of us. So super excited to have both these guests back on where we can all just kind of talk about the field and archaeology now that they've been introduced to the audience. So, but reintroductions are in order. So Terrell, if you wouldn't mind starting us off, just introducing yourself back to the audience.
Yeah, my name is Terrell Iron Eyes. I'm the tribal archaeologist for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Happy to be here. Happy to be back.
And you, Chance.
Yeah, my name's Chance Ward. I'm a tribal member of Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in North Central South Dakota, but I currently live here in Denver, and I work with History Colorado in Denver as the NAGPRA coordinator, and happy to be here again.
Sweet. Super excited to have both of you on. So out of the three of us, Terrell's the only one that is actually like employed through his nation, working with his nation. Me and Chance are out and about not doing that. And so, I mean, starting us off, and not to say that Terrell doesn't have experience in this, but just starting off with you, Chance, right off the bat, you know, dude, what is it like, especially working at History Colorado, being a Native professional in an institution that's not necessarily built for Native voices?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I never quite imagined myself in this position or in this type of agency or state agency, but it's interesting. I think my original goal was to, you know, gain the knowledge and experience so that I can help my own tribe or even a different tribe with my knowledge and expertise. But being here, I think it just kind of gives another voice for Native people in an institution that doesn't have a lot of Native employees. Currently, there's three of us here. I know we have a few hundred staff members, but because we also have 8 community museums across the state. But here at this specific location in Denver, there's three of us, me and our director of engagement, who you're related to, and then our one of our other community engagement folks is Noelle, and she's Muscalero.
Oh, so you got like three big groups of Plains Indians in History Colorado. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. And it's fun when the three of us get together because we can talk and bounce ideas and thoughts off each other. And we kind of have a similar knowledge and understanding, but of course, different individual experiences. But so they're great and wonderful to work with. I'm glad they're here. But it's also good to be here too, because I can be that sort of middle person between the institution or the museum, the agency, and in between with tribes. And if I can help create a better environment, a better consultation, a better meeting, sometimes I think of issues or concerns that might come up in meetings, and, you know, maybe staff is kind of wording things weirdly. And if I can identify or be aware of that, I can let them know that's probably not a good way to word things together.
Absolutely. I'm sure your presence is definitely absolutely needed at History Colorado. But for you, Terrell, like, you didn't get a degree from a tribal college, correct? But you went to a big state university that's not necessarily meant for Native folks.
So my like whole academic journey is its own twists and turns. So I fresh out of high school, I went to North Dakota State University. I was originally going to go for engineering because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and engineers made money. And I got there, and after 1 year or two semesters there, I wound up actually like dropping out. I struggled so hard with like kind of that culture shock where, because I grew up on Standing Rock, I grew up in a very tribal community and everything. And so my like biggest, my graduating class in high school was 25 students. All of them were Lakota and all of them looked like me. And then I went to NDSU where like one of my smallest classes was like 150 kids and none of them looked like me. And it was this huge like mental hurdle. And so I dropped out from this big state school and I went home and I did a year at my tribal college before going back. And then that coincided with the Dakota Access protests and everything that brought with it. And I was like, man, I don't care about engineering. I was like, I cared so much more about the culture and my people and making sure that those things were protected. And so I made the shift there. And even then, like, even though I was a lot more engaged and a lot happier with what I was studying, there was still all of those kind of institutional pieces where it's not built for us. One of like the big fights that I always had was the citations referencing things where I'm like, this is all stuff that like my elders taught me or that I learned just being around my people. I don't know how to put that in like a work cited. I don't know how to put that in a bibliography. And at the time when I first started, like there really wasn't a whole lot there. And now if you pull up like style guides, they have ways for you to reference that, like oral histories, traditional ecological knowledge, however they want to categorize it. But even then, I still feel like the way that they ask us to format those sources definitely still is biased towards like a Western institution and is predicated on the idea that these are structured interviews that you're having with people as opposed to just learning through interaction, learning through osmosis. Earlier, I was going to point out it's really funny how small Indian country is because Chance's in Denver working with one of Carlton's relatives. And I met both of you through very different means, but I was also aware of both of you prior to ever meeting you because I'd meet other natives in the space and like, oh, have you met Carlton yet? Have you met Chance yet? And I was like, nope, I'm sure I will at some point. And Absolutely did. And like, even now it's just, it feels like there's a lot of us in the space, but it's because we all interact with each other. And as soon as you stop interacting with like other natives, you realize just how few of us there actually are. It's really when I met Chance like through work, it was really funny too, because there was a repatriation thing and one of my council members came with me to do it. And when we were filling our council in, letting them know like what was happening, I said Chance's name and one of them kind of picked his head up and he's like, I think I know him. I think I've met him before. And we pulled up down there and Chance came up and he's like, yeah, we were in New Mexico together. And he was like, yeah. It was just a really wild connection.
100%. I mean, but that also speaks to what you were saying about not when you're at NDSU, North Dakota State University, and not seeing folks like you, you know, like at these conferences. Because, Gerald, we met at that Plains conference, I think the first time in person.
Yep.
And it was like immediately like the 7 to 10 natives in the room usually just kind of hang out together at these conferences like pretty quickly early on and just like connect and move as a unit. Because it's just much easier to be at a professional conference in spaces with people that either look like you or think like you and can have a much better time about, you know, conferencing than it is with some of the other folks in particular. That need for community not only works in a conference space, but then also like informing approaches to archaeology preservation, right? Like how the three of us in our different contexts inform our work through our cultural practices. And so, Terrell, you're much more in that space of directly being able to advocate for Lakota needs at a ground level with all these other institutions. So like, what are those interactions like when you're working? Like, cause you went on a field school field trip this summer across like the Rocky Mountain West, Great Plains, and also in like Minnesota. And you just went field school hopping and being, quote, an agent of chaos.
It was a great time. Before I wound up in my current role, I had various positions at NDSU. And one of the things that like I miss about that is working with students. Like, I don't know, like there's something about like an academic environment where you get to watch like students who are just now learning these things that we kind of take for granted being in the field for as long as we have, and watching them come to terms with it, grapple with it, or find like their own pieces of it to pick at. Like, I really miss that. And I get some of that with these like tribal consultations, because we come to these meetings and I'm a relative newcomer to all of it. Like, I've been involved with Standing Rock Tribal Historic Preservation Office for about 5 years, but that was on a much lower level than where I've been for about the last three. And so when I go to these meetings, there's people that have been there for 7, 10, 15 years, and I get to hear their stories of what these meetings used to be like, the fights that they used to have to try and get tribal participation, tribal monitors, stuff that now most agencies are happy to do because they've been through the fights, they've seen the benefits of us being boots on the ground right from the start. I have a cold and I'm still haven't quite shaken the cough. But I'm definitely more of a regulatory archaeologist at this point than like CRM or anything else. But there's been a lot of progress made in the last probably 10 years or so in the field, which isn't to say that it's perfect by any means. Like, it's this incremental steps, and sometimes it gets legislated that the best practices that were once kind of elective processes are now mandatory at like a federal level. And then sometimes that gets legislated away. Like, currently we have 7 days to review anything that gets slotted under energy emergency, which is an incredibly vague term. Like, there's some things that come through where it's like, we're going to be digging for oil, energy emergency, energy independence. You have 7 days to review it. And then there's other times where a company is going to move from above ground power lines to below ground power lines. And they're like, energy emergency, 7 days. And it's like, these two things are very different in impact and like immediate need, depending on what it is that you're looking at. Like, I would still argue that the oil isn't necessarily an immediate need, but again, like, it's a very different ends of the spectrum, but because of how vague of a statement energy crisis, energy emergency is, it can be used to justify really anything, which is kind of like one of the current fights that we're having with like the federal agencies and state agencies, is trying to ensure that they maintain compliance with the federal laws, because it's a real gray area if you're trying to use this EO that doesn't have a lot of definition attached to it.
And EO being executive order. All right, so that's a good stopping point. We'll be right back with segment two of episode 27. We'll tap back into Chance. Stay tuned after these messages.
And we're back with episode 27. So, like, transition this over to you, Chance. What is that experience like? You're working in History Colorado, which is the state museum, reporting directly to the governor, and you have to be that interface with the tribes around an incredibly important topic, the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act, on getting an entire institution that's in Denver and its satellite institutions across the state of Colorado in compliance. And so how's that dynamic where you have to explain to your higher ups why you need the resources or funding that you need, or trying to be that translator between these cultural practices and the bureaucratic process in a state institution?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think one thing I'm happy with is I think the staff here is very supportive, very understanding that this work needs to happen, and I'm trusted to do my job is what I really like. There's no questioning of why I'm doing things or if I'm doing things a certain way. There's no why this, why that. They sort of give me full trust and control to handle organizing consultation meetings to invite tribes to come to Denver, or, you know, any letter writing, email writing, phone call communication. Nobody ever asked me why this or why that. I think they fully understand and support it needs to happen, but I think everyone's kind of on board with, not kind of on board, everyone's on board with repatriation. I think everyone understands the history of museums and anthropology with Native people, and they understand that some of these objects that we have might have come in through unethical means or in times of duress. And, you know, all tribes need to do is tell us that it's important to them. And that's all we really need to hear. It's all I need to hear. You know, I understand that we still use a lot of these things in our everyday life, in our culture, in our ceremonies. And that's what we're here to do. You know, I want History Colorado to continue being a leader in NAGPRA, in repatriation. You know, we're not here to keep anything. We're not here to perpetuate that old school way of thinking of, you know, these are our things. These are our collections. You know, we have control over them, you know, kind of the opposite of what was in the news in the last year and a half. You know, some museums are kind of not really willing to work with tribes or return objects that they're being told are important to them, even today. So, yeah, I get plenty of staff support. My supervisors are very supportive. Of course, we run on a state budget, so it's not going to be super duper high or anything, but we have budget to work with tribes, create consultation meetings, provide all the necessary things to make it happen as best as we can. So I'm really happy that my staff, their supervisors, are very understanding.
Excellent. That sounds awesome, man. So kind of leading us on to this next topic, from different perspectives, like looking at the on-the-ground archaeological world to in the museum context, like, why does it matter, you know, to both of you, and we'll start off with you again, Chance, why does it matter to have Native people leading archaeological and preservation work within the context of our, you know, American Indian history here in the United States, and that record specifically?
Yeah, and, you know, before, kind of mirror what Rob was talking about, when I graduated high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I ended up going to a college in the state of South Dakota that ended up shutting down in the middle of a semester because it ran out of money. And if anybody listening remembers the old Tonka University, I actually went there its last year of operation, and it closed down in the middle of a semester because it ran out of money, you know. And that was kind of my first experience with really no idea what I wanted to do. And it took me another couple of years after that to finally go to college and take it a little bit more serious this time around. So I went to, you know, SIPI, which is a tribal college in Albuquerque. And that's kind of where I like to say it really got me a start on my academic journey, my education journey. It kind of set the beginning for me and laid the foundation. I eventually went to Fort Lewis in Durango, and that's where I ended up choosing anthropology and, you know, taking all these different classes on archaeology, museum studies, ethnography. And, you know, that's kind of the first time I became aware that there was a lack of Native people in these fields. You know, it was done by these old colonial institutions, and the, you know, the stereotype is these old white guys with PhDs and still wearing like pith helmets. And, you know, once I kind of got that in my mind, that's where I specifically decided to change my major and focus on archaeology. You know, I took all the classes I could, ended up joining the NAGPRA repatriation committee for Fort Lewis to kind of give me some exposure to what a consultation meeting was between university professors and tribal elders, TIPO staff. And I knew that I wanted to be a voice in archaeology. If I could do anything, it would be to speak up when I needed to, if I had to. And that's kind of what drove me to go into archaeology or CRM work. And, you know, even today, even though I'm not so much in the CRM work, I'm more in the museum side nowadays, it's still important to have Native people in these positions, in these spaces, right? It's our history, right? And by ours, I mean Native people. And of course, it's going to be tribal specific wherever you're located. You know, it's important. It's important to have our own people in charge of our own history, our own culture, our own material culture left behind. And for us, it's that fingerprint, right? It's that fingerprint left behind, written in the land. It's not a written document left behind. It's written into the landscape. And that's what we need to keep protected so that it can be continued on for next generations to see and learn and take part of. And, you know, also just as an expression of tribal sovereignty. So, you know, same thing here in the museums. I hope to see more and more Native people going into archaeology and museums.
Absolutely. And another throwback to how small Indian country is, that's at SIPI is where you met my nephew, Will.
That's right. He organized the drum group practice. So being at a tribal college and just like Terrell said, it's seems like a big world, but Indian country isn't as big as it feels like, because it seems like everybody knows somebody that you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, and same question for you, Terrell. Like, why do more Native folks need to be in charge? And off of that, you know, through your career, have you started to see more CRM firms or, you know, university field schools have more Native students? Like, are you seeing a trend rising?
I'll start with the first part of that question, and we'll come back to the second piece. One of the things that, like, comes up a lot with archaeology now and doing, like, any sort of, like, cultural studies, there's the question, or not even question, but there's like this guidance of talk to the farmers, talk to the ranchers, talk to the landowners, talk to the people that have been in the area. And a lot of times, like, they can point you in the direction of cultural resources or anything like that because they've been there for so long. And this is just kind of accepted as like a common knowledge. But when you try to extend that, there used to be like a real big push or like hesitance, probably the right word, towards extending that to tribes, to Native nations. But if you're willing to accept that a farmer probably has innate knowledge of the land because they've been there for so long, that extends with these tribes too. A lot of us have stories that predate us in modern era by thousands of years. We know what these landscapes were like. We know what the wildlife was like. We know so much about those areas where even if we don't have a current or continuous connection there, our stories still remember those spaces. When I first started, my old boss, John Eagle, told me, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher it, but I'm thinking, which means long ago our ancestors wrote our story on the land. And that's what, at least in the Great Plains, what a lot of archaeology is. A lot of pre-contact archaeology is looking for teepee rings, to use kind of the common parlance for it, but it's these record of our history. I was in a meeting with, I think, Fish and Wildlife. Might have been someone else, but we were in North Platte, Nebraska, and we were talking about this big project, and they were talking about untouched wilderness that it'd be going through. And I had to remind them that just because our towns looked different than the downtown of North Platte didn't mean that it was untouched, or didn't mean that it was no less significant. It just means that it looked different. But if you don't know what it is you're looking for, and if you don't have that kind of cultural connection, it's really easy to not see it.
miss the forest for the trees in a way, where tribes, we've continued it. Like, it's a continued tradition. We call them archaeological, but some of these sites could have been made 30 years ago because we never stopped. It's continuing tradition, continuing use. And if you don't engage tribes on this, you miss that. You lose the, again, like that very real cultural continuity. As for more Native representation, I think it's starting to trend up. My sample size is obviously pretty small at this point, but it does seem like there's more and more. It seems like every conference I go to, there's more students, more Native students that are looking to get into the field. I haven't worked with a ton of Native CRM individuals. There's a couple that I've worked with, but, and I think that might be something that like Native students considering a career might want to think more about, because I feel like a lot of us end up either in like these more regulatory roles like myself or more academic roles. I feel like we're kind of missing that CRM piece because of past negative experiences. But I do think that we're in a position for more Native youth to kind of take that specific part of the field to task and improve it. But we have to be willing to do that, right? And I don't know that we're in an exact political climate to allow for that.
Right.
But I do think that it's something to that we should consider and kind of encourage more.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people forget that those landscapes were managed landscapes, right? Like a lot of people think it's pristine. A good example comes to mind up in like northeastern Nebraska in Boyd County, where there's this whole forest of lodgepole pines that shouldn't be there. And folks are like, yeah, they grow naturally. I'm like, IDK, like there's a bunch of Ponca and Pawnee sites around here. And like lodgepole pines are great for teepees. Are you telling me like, that's not a managed forest specifically put there for cult for construction? Just goofy. But all right, that's all we have for this episode. We'll be in part two. So in episode 28 with Chance and Terrell, we're going to be talking more about archaeology. So we'll be getting a little bit more into some fun stories and things of the like. Thank you guys for joining, and we will see you next time. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy, our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht, and our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.